Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hi, I'm Dawn O'Porter, and welcome to So Lucky, where each week I go deep with my guest and explore all of the sides to all of their stories, the highs and lows, their hopes and fears, their lucky and their unlucky moments. My guest this week is Clara Francis, an actress and designer and, full disclosure, a dear friend of mine. I want to give you the heads up about this episode because we talk about something really upsetting. In fact, we talk about every parent's worst nightmare, the death of a child. I'm so moved by Clara's openness in this conversation. It's unlike anything else in this series, and it is hard to listen to, but it's really worth it. I wanted Clara to be a guest on this podcast because her story about losing her daughter Maud is devastating, but the way that her and her husband Jason have got through it is very inspiring. I actually based the character of Ruby in my novel on Clara, and over the course of getting to know her, researching that character, I fell in love with her so deeply. And she's a bit of a curveball guest for me on this podcast, but I really, really wanted to talk to her and I wanted to share her story. So strap in, because this is a big one. This is me, Dawn O'Porter, talking to the wonderful Clara Francis.
Well, here we are in a little booth. Yeah. Being all like podcasty.
Yeah.
Clara, I really wanted you on my podcast for so many reasons.
Tell me why.
Well, first is that, I mean, obviously this is the So Lucky podcast and I kind of based a character on you, which I'm so proud of. You were my first, all of my books have always been like a kind of version of me somehow. And you were my first like fully researched. This is, I met someone who became the person. I want to be really clear.
A nice version.
Yes, a nice version. I want to be clear. You're not Ruby. You're absolutely not Ruby. But the story that you told me at a mutual friend, Alex's hen do, is what kind of inspired her condition. So I was at a hen do and got chatting to Clara, and Clara started telling me, and you're so open about this, is what I love about you, and no one else is, which is why I had to get you on. Mm-hmm. You started telling me about your body hair that you had battled with for most of your life.
I have. I just excess body hair has been the bane of my life. And until about 5 years ago.
And so when, what did you do?
So when I got married, my husband said to me, I'm going to get you a gift for our wedding day.
Right.
I'm going to get you a piece of jewellery. What would you like? A ring. He likes to buy me rings. And I went, I don't want a ring. I want full body laser hair.
Right.
That is what I want for my wedding present.
A lovely, romantic, sexy present.
Absolutely. It's the best thing I've ever done in my whole life.
Yeah.
Because being a really hairy person, and I'm not just talking about like a little bit hairy. Mm-hmm. I mean, really hairy hair that grows everywhere. It's really difficult. I mean, you can't just go swimming.
Right.
Things like that. I mean, I know it sounds like nothing.
No, it's not nothing.
It doesn't sound like much, but you can't just, you know, impromptu say, oh yeah, I'm going to go to the ponds today with my friends, because it's like, oh, but I'm mid-cycle. So I can't really show my legs or my bikini line in public because it was really, really bad.
Yeah.
And I always thought that I had a curse put on me. Did I tell you this at the hen do?
No.
When I was a little girl, my mum took me through the ponds on Hampstead Heath, and there was a woman there, and she was really old, elderly, and she sort of looked like a witch, and she had pubic hair like down to her knees, and I was with my friend and I took the piss out of her. Oh. And I laughed at her.
Oh.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's why.
And I think I was cursed.
Gosh.
Yes, because it happened to me. It happened to
me. How old were you when it started?
So probably, yeah, 12. Ah, yeah. Now, this is also interesting. I was sort of had hair on my armpits before I was in primary school, because there was a girl called Lucy in my primary school who, she said, "Oh, Clara," we were at swimming. Mm-hmm. "Clara, show everyone how good you are at diving." And I, you know, I was like, oh my God, she's showing me attention.
Right.
So I got up and I put my arms in the air and she started laughing at me because I had hair under my arms. So I was obviously an early developer.
Yeah.
And then I really remember noticing it in sort of at the beginning of secondary school. And I used to have dreams about the hairs on the top of my legs, which uh-huh. my mum had said, don't ever shave them, don't shave them, because it'll grow back thicker,
yeah.
but of course you do. And I would have dreams about sort of shaving it off, but it growing back, but it wasn't hair, it was like trees. I can't really explain.
Right, okay, so like, this is, it kind of came back as like thick stumps.
It was thick stumps of like right. bulk.
Yeah, and this is you as a teenager.
This was probably about 12, 13.
Right.
And then I have memories of walking around my garden in the summer with Jolan. Do you remember?
Yes, yeah, so I used it on my upper lip.
Well, obviously, we all did. And it went a nice sort of yellowy hue,
yeah.
did it not? I would Jolan the hairs on my legs, because thinking, well, maybe I don't shave it and I'll just... But then I sort of had like yellowy green legs.
Right.
Yellowy green hairy legs. So it sort of took a while. And then I kind of started having it waxed when I could afford to have my legs waxed. But then you go into a cycle of, well, I have to let the hair grow
yeah.
before... So you'd have sort of a heat wave and I'd be wearing over-the-knee socks
right.
on the hottest day of the year. And it's not... It sort of sounds like real vanity. But if I took the socks off, I looked like a 1970s footballer. It
right.
wasn't like a little bit of hair. It was like extremely thick hair.
Yeah.
Extremely thick, like a bloke.
Right.
Like a very, very hairy bloke.
God.
Yeah.
And that was you, like, from teenage all through your 20s?
All through my 20s and my early 30s. No, actually, I was 40. I was 40 when I had them lasered. So pretty much my whole adult life.
And how does that affect you as a person? Because obviously, just to keep reinstating the fact that Ruby was inspired by you, but mm-hmm. is not you as a
no.
person. So anyone who's read the book and thinks that I'm talking to real life Ruby,
no,
that's not the case.
Really nice.
And she's lovely, Clara. She's,
nice.
Although I took your fashion, because the high neck dresses
yeah,
and the
yeah.
things. Yeah, Clara wears yeah. the most amazing dresses that you make yourself. And you've just started a company.
I have, O'Pioneers. Right,
let's plug that
yeah,
for a second and make sure that we do. So follow them on Instagram.
Yeah, yeah. I started making clothes about a year ago with my amazing sewing teacher, Chris Winter. Just going to her house, watching her work, just driving her mad,
yeah.
saying, this is what I want to make. And then she helped me make patterns because I could never find things that I really loved.
Yes.
So I found my perfect dress, and now I'm sharing it with the world.
Well, and this I stole that as
well
because
yeah,
that's what Ruby does. So I just love
exactly.
that so much. And
yeah.
if more women like found their perfect dress
yeah.
and like based their entire style on it,
yeah.
we'd all be dressing so happily.
I know. Well, now I mean, I am so happy, and also I don't have to go into shops anymore and alter stuff or
yeah.
shit fabrics. I can buy my perfect fabric and make my perfect dress, and I can alter it, alter sleeves. I mean, it's so liberating. I recommend everyone learn how to sew.
Yeah,
it's incredible.
I know. It's a
skill. What a skill.
It's a skill that we just kind of we tried to get out of for so long, and now I'd love to be able to sew.
But it's not that hard.
No,
it's not that hard because everything I make is really simple. I don't go for anything fancy.
Yeah.
So I mean, it's an incredible skill, but you can do it on a pretty basic level,
yeah.
which is what I do.
Yeah. So I love
yeah.
the one you've got on today.
Thank
so
you.
So lovely ruched sleeves and star print. It's so cute. I'm totally going to get one. So where was I before I was talking about your amazing
hairiness.
Clothes? Hairiness. Right, hairiness. So you kind of developed a style that did that. So right, so you had this issue in your life up until you were 40. Now, what I find really fascinating about you is, unlike Ruby again, you didn't hide away. You were an actress. So what talk me through that, that, you know, inner monologue of, I've got this physical condition that makes me feel gross, yet I want to put myself out there to the world.
Yeah. Well, oh God. Oh, no. I mean, I was an actress, then I wasn't an actress, now I'm an actress again. And I stopped being an actress sort of because I have had, because I weirdly have more self-esteem now than I ever had, very low self-esteem. And I think when you have, because along with the hairiness came the spottiness.
Oh, right.
As well. And I had really bad skin. And it was all because I had polycystic ovaries, but I didn't know I had polycystic ovaries. I just thought I was a hairy, spotty, deeply unattractive human being. And so I would offer the hairiness I could cover up. Mm-hmm. You can sort of cover up. And I had to do one sex scene once, but I can't remember how I wangled my way around it. It could have been sort of at the right time in my cycle. If it hadn't have been, I probably would have just shaved.
Right.
Because it would have been too awful not to. But having really bad skin when you're an actress, when I was younger, it was awful. Because my first agent would say to me, you know, your skin's really bad, you've got to sort it out. And I mean, you know, it was always like the elephant in the room. And she took me to a dermatologist because, I wouldn't get work because of it. Because if they can cast an actress who's got perfect skin. Mm-hmm. And I remember, and then it came to the point where I remember my other agent afterwards saying to me, God, the director just said you didn't want the job. He just thought you didn't want the job. And I remember that audition and I remember thinking, I'm so hideous and spotty and awful. I couldn't make eye contact with him. I remember being in the room. And then I went to the doctor and the dermatologist said to me, I remember, said, you're going to be like this until you have children and then your hormones will sort themselves out.
Right.
And that really did happen.
Did it?
Yeah, I mean, it did. And also I think I started having microdermabrasion. God, I didn't know I'd go down this road talking about this.
This is great.
I didn't know that. But I had microdermabrasion and it really helped me. It really helped my skin. And it is amazing how unconfident I felt when my skin was bad.
I bet.
It is. Again, it sounds really vain. But I think if you are an actor and you're putting yourself out there and you've got a camera right up in your face, it's pretty mortifying.
Yeah, but for anybody also, I think it's perfectly okay to be like, to have something like that going on and admit to how that kind of debilitates your character a bit and makes you feel really self-conscious.
Oh, it was awful. I remember doing a commercial in Madrid and just having a really terrible breakout. It was for a Renault Clio commercial and just thinking, oh my God, I've got to get up at 5 and they're going, because they would say it out loud.
Yeah.
They'd say, oh my God, your skin's really bad. Or what, you know, and they'd sort of make out that it was so awful that how are they going to cover it up? And of course they did. And so I remember getting up really early and covering my spots myself and then getting there and them going, why have you done that? I mean, just humiliating.
Yeah.
So one good thing about getting old is I don't actually get really bad spots anymore.
That's great.
Yeah. And I am no longer as hairy as I used to be.
So did the lasering just work?
The lasering worked. I mean, I'm still like, I'm now would say I'm hairy like a normal person.
Okay.
And, you know, I'm just a normal human being now. I'm not a person with excess body hair. Because I also have my beard. Yeah, I facial hair as well. We haven't even discussed this. So facial hair, I've done a couple of times. Because, you know, you sort of, and when you have your facial hair done, you have to grow it.
Yeah. Oh God, that's the painful part.
You have to grow it because when you go to the salon, they need to shave it off to know where to laser. And so I grew it and I sort of went into hiding and wore polo necks. And then on my way to the clinic, and I was living in Kentish Town at the time, and I went to a clinic in Spitalfields, and I stopped off in Islington and I bumped into an ex-boyfriend, you know, and I had,
I don't know.
And it was so awful. And I sort of pulled my polo neck up so it was kind of under my nose.
Oh my God.
Yeah. So anyway,
of course
you're going to bump into an old boyfriend when you've got a full like beard. Of course you are. So, so that was the first, I did that in probably in my early 30s. And so I didn't have facial hair So I got rid of that, and actually that made my skin better. Oh God, awful. I'd get up early and have to pluck.
Yeah.
That's what I would do. I'd get up early. But this is a time when you're kind of going out and you're meeting people and you're going back with men. And I'd wake up in the morning thinking, have I got a beard? Or how bad is my skin? Oh, it was awful.
And so how was it when you met your love and when you dealt with all of that?
I didn't even tell him. I don't think I told him. I was really secretive. I really was so mortified by the whole thing. I would get up early and do the old plucking.
Right.
Do a sort of 30-minute pluck in the toilet, in the loo, and come in with a sort of red speckled face.
God.
Because rather that than him see my beard.
Well, so there must have been a point, though, because another thing that I stole from your life in the book was because Jason made a joke about it in his wedding speech.
He did.
And you seem to be absolutely fine with that. But
it.
I, you know, it was cataclysmic for Ruby.
Yeah, yeah.
But, like, that's a bold move for a husband.
Yeah, but I can laugh at myself.
Yes, you can.
I mean, I think it's really important to be able to laugh at yourself. I mean, because if really, I mean, I've been through quite a lot of shit in my life. And even at my darkest, on the darkest day of my life, I still managed to find something to laugh about. And I just think, God, you've just got to be able to laugh. So when I got married, it was all to do with him saying to me, I'm going to buy you a ring, and me saying, no, I want to put the money towards. So he said in my wedding speech, because I love dogs.
Right.
It's the other thing. I love dogs. And he has always said that he thinks I'm sort of half human, half dog. And my hairiness is a part of that. So his wedding speech was pretty much just about how I'm half dog. And I just thought it was hilarious. It was a really hilarious speech.
Yeah.
It was brilliant.
Okay, good.
And I love it. And I've printed it out, and sometimes I look at it and it still makes me laugh.
That's so wonderful. So sorry to do this, but I do. Can we go to that darkest
day of your life?
It's fine.
Let's go there.
I'm going to let you say it in your own words because I wouldn't want to.
Okay. Well, I...
unless you want me to say it.
Oh, well, you say it.
Okay.
You say it.
So Clara and Jason lost a 2-year-old, your daughter, Maud.
Yeah.
I mean, I can't actually talk about it without crying, so I don't know how the fuck you do it.
I can talk about it.
Okay. Well, you're amazing. And like, obviously, every parent's worst nightmare. And so on that day, you say you still managed to find a laugh.
Well, I mean, I did. I wouldn't say I was rollicking around laughing, but I sort of had. One of my girlfriends, Rebecca, at the time was looking for a man, and I had sort of made it my life's ambition to find her somebody. And the policeman had come in when my daughter died, and it was too awful, but I kind of was looking at this policeman thinking, oh, he might do for Bex.
Oh, God, Clara, I know. No, your brain is just doing all these different things.
I was like, I'll ask him if he's single. And then I was like, what the fuck? Fuck. So, I mean, I wouldn't say it was like I was laughing hilariously, you know, but you know, and then in the days after, I mean, so I'll just say a little bit about what happened with Maud. So she was 2.5, and she had the flu, and it was around Christmas time. And Jason and I, you know, didn't think anything of it because we weren't neurotic, weren't then. And she couldn't shake off this flu. And it got, I'm cutting a very long story short, it got progressively worse. And then the day before New Year's Eve, she was having problems breathing. And so I took her to A&E, and they sort of fobbed me off and said, oh, it's fine, it's croup. And I had had croup a lot as a kid. I always remember my mum saying, so I was like, oh, right, okay. Because my instinct was it was really bad. But, you know, you're sort of, I was so happy when they told me that it was something that's pretty minor. I was like, fine. They gave her some steroids. We went home. And then the next day was New Year's Eve, and it was worse. And she was really struggling to breathe. And then she stopped breathing, and we ran in the car. We drove down to UCH, to the A&E. And again, they said, it's fine. It's fine. It's the croup. It's fine. And they gave us some more steroids. and they told us to go home. And again, I was like, oh, this is great. Because my instinct is there's something seriously wrong here. But I should have gone with my instinct. I know that now. This is the biggest regret of my life. But, you know, hindsight is a wonderful thing.
Yeah. And of course you believe what you want to believe what a doctor tells you.
Of course you do. And until you're sort of hit by tragedy, I just think you do. And well, maybe some people don't. And I have met people that have told me that they've stood in A&E and they've screamed and shouted until they got what they wanted. But I'm just not that sort of person. I wasn't that sort of person. I don't know how I'd be now. Uh-huh. And I think, God, I wish I was that sort of person that won't take no for an answer. But it didn't even occur to me.
Of course.
It just didn't. I was delighted that it wasn't as serious as I thought. And then, so it was New Year's Eve. We were due to go out. We thought, oh, we better stay in because she's really not very well. And then it was New Year's Day 2011. And our other daughter, Bessie, came in our room and said, I can't wake up Maud. I can't wake her up because they shared a room. And I just knew. And then everything, you know, then your world is, you know, my life, it was sort of changed forever.
Yeah.
And is very much divided into two parts, before and after. And that moment was the after. And it is the worst thing. It's the worst thing. I mean, I can't even describe how awful it is because it's so unspeakably awful. Mm-hmm. There aren't words.
It's the actual, I think any human would agree that it's the literal worst thing that could happen.
Yeah, because I was like, just kill me. I mean, you sort of think, give me anything, make me blind, give me cancer, cut my legs off, just do anything to me, but just give me my little girl back. Just don't do that. Just don't do it. But of course, you're bargaining with the world and it's already happened. And so, yeah, it's for any parent, it's unspeakable. So I sort of feel that Jason and I have, well, this was 8 years ago, nearly nine. And we've just sort of been rebuilding our lives and doing a lot of campaigning. Because actually Maud died of sepsis and it was undiagnosed at the hospital. They didn't do anything wrong. There was just no protocol for detecting it at the time. There is now. We at Sepsis UK Trust have done a lot of work to try and kind of spread the word, and things are changing in hospitals because sepsis is a secondary illness. So it's not, you will have something else. So she had the flu and then she got the sepsis.
Right.
And it's really difficult to detect.
What is sepsis?
It's people think it's blood poisoning like septicemia, but it isn't. So sepsis is when you have an illness and your body goes into overdrive. All your organs go into overdrive to try and fight the illness. But actually what happens is your organs start fighting each other.
Right.
And essentially it kills you.
Okay.
And you can test for it, but they just didn't. But they're really on it now. Certain hospitals are really on it. I know UCH, where we've taken her, they're really, really on it now.
Okay.
So to know that your child died and she didn't have to die is a double blow. But I think I'm pretty practical. Mm-hmm. And I made a choice that I was going to, you know, not kill myself, and that I was, which I wanted to do. Mm-hmm. But I had another little girl, my daughter, and I was like, I can't do that to her. I can't do it to my mother. I have to carry on and live a good life. And that's what I've tried to do, and not be bitter and angry at the world and the situation and the doctors that, you know, because I kind of think, well, they're humans. And people make mistakes, and I'm pretty sure they feel fucking awful about it.
Yeah.
But it really was a choice because I remember in the early days thinking I could go out and I could get pissed and I could take loads of drugs and I could just, you know, really fuck myself up.
Mm-hmm.
And that would be the easy thing to do. But I'm not going to do that. And I'm going to try and make something good of this.
Yeah.
Which I kind of hope I have. We had another child, Jason and I. That was really important to me.
And how was that experience?
It was bloody awful.
Right.
It was fucking awful because I got pregnant really soon after.
Uh-huh.
So I was pregnant and grieving.
Right.
And not on any sort of antidepressant, which I think would have helped.
Right.
You know, I think, I think grief is very different from depression. And I'm not saying everybody who's grieving should go on antidepressants.
Uh-huh.
But for me, I had on and off been on antidepressants my adult life.
Right.
So to not be on them at the darkest time of my life was really difficult. And they'd said to me, you can take them, but there is a risk of harming the baby. And I was like, do you know what? I don't want to do that. So I'm just not. So I was pregnant with Gilbert and just sort of going cold turkey grief and with sort of raging pregnancy hormones and also the fear that something was going to happen because, you know, I was sort of plummeted into a world where terrible things happened to me.
Yeah.
Being a person, and I was a person that I was not neurotic. I was like, nothing bad's going to ever happen to me. Why would it? Why do I think I'm so special? But it did. And I think once something like that happens to you, the door is open and you can't close that door. The door of sort of tragedy. And, you know, you will jump to the worst case scenario, which is what I do. Less so now, 8 years on.
Yeah.
But certainly then.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
So did you really have to watch yourself with the other two kids that you didn't become overprotective?
Yeah.
And allow them to live life?
Yeah, yeah. But I still, I don't think I'm very good at it.
Well, here's the thing. I mean, I feel that since becoming a parent, my anxiety is just something that is a daily mission to try and control with my... I had a tragedy when I was younger than my mom died. I really relate to that thing. Once that worst thing has happened, which is kind of in reverse to what happened to you at that age for me, you expect it to happen.
Mm.
So for me, like when I became a mum, that kind of new mum anxiety is very real. And I'm like, well, the worst thing can happen.
Yeah.
And it does happen.
Yeah, yeah.
So
So it was like a trigger for you.
Yes.
Having kids was a total trigger.
Kind of. Yeah. And actually, do you know what? I'm getting asked all the time at the moment how losing my mum affected me. It affects me as having a mum. And I'm always like, to be honest, I don't really think about my mum dying. I don't miss her anymore. It's like, it's very different. But yes, that's absolutely something. I am aware that the worst thing can happen. So, but mums have that anyway, different to our experiences. That's, Chris has that, and he's never lost a parent or anything like that. And so I think to put on, you know, something as tragic as what happened to Maud on top of that anxiety that you already have as a parent is something that just must take constant management.
I'm definitely better now than I was initially. I mean, when Gilbert was born, I thought he was going to die. I mean, I would say for the first 2 years, I would have to take a deep breath every time I went into his room because I thought I would find him dead. Every single morning, I would have to take a deep breath. And even now, because he's, we were, as we were discussing before we went out, we were talking about the fact he doesn't sleep very much. He's a really early riser, so he's usually up about 5:30. If he sleeps in, my brain immediately goes to this. So this is how it works. Oh, I can't hear Gilbert upstairs because I usually hear him crashing around. He's probably dead. Okay. How am I going to handle this? I can't go through that again. So I'm going to go upstairs and I'm just going to get a knife and I'm just going to kill myself.
Right.
And then I hear him. And I go, oh, it's okay. So there, it's sort of, I spiral. It's certainly not as bad, but I will go to that place.
Yeah, I bet you do.
I've met, you know, lots of other bereaved people now. I go to an incredible bereavement group called Slow, Surviving the Loss of Your World, which is a group set up by two bereaved mums, and it's run by bereaved people.
Right.
So, you know, there's no sort of therapist who've learned how to talk to me. It's really an incredible sort of setup. So I'm sort of surrounded by people that have lost children now. And some people really don't have it. They really don't. But I think it's dependent on how your child has died.
Yeah.
I think, everybody's different. I think if your child's had a long illness and it's an expected death, you probably don't have it. Friends don't have that as much, that right. I'm going to walk in the room and my child's going to be dead.
Okay.
But they have completely different set of
well, they had a chance,
triggers.
They had a chance to accept the situation, I suppose.
You
get an opportunity to prepare. I don't know. Fuck knows. What do I know? But I just can... there's no good scenario on this. But the shock of what happened to you. I mean, Art had flu last year. 7 days with fever at 104. And to think that could just turn into something.
Yeah,
it could
I know.
Be any of us any time.
Yeah.
And it's so, you don't think that, of course. And if a doctor tells you he'll be fine in a couple of days, just give him lots of fluids and that's what you do. And you think everything's going to be fine. So the shock of it and the feeling of could we done something and all of that. But when there's a long illness, then you've got the opportunity to... you know there's nothing you can do.
Yeah, yeah.
So
I don't think the
that.
Grieving process is any different. I don't think you feel the grief
no,
any less.
Yes.
But you have a different set of... I was talking to a friend on Sunday who lost her son and it was an expected death. And we were talking about this and, you know, this sort of notion that somehow it's easier to manage if you know that your child is going to die, but it kind of isn't. It's just a very different...
it's just a different
it's
scenario.
It's a different thing. What's better? I mean, we were talking about it in context of what is better, to know your child is going to die and have that time to say goodbye, to prepare, or to not know your child's going to die and have the shock? Because actually... the trauma that you go through while your child is dying is really difficult. I mean, it's they're two totally different hideous things. It's I mean, like who I don't want either. Thank you very much.
I know.
I'd rather no child died.
I had that conversation. I think it was yesterday where I said I think maybe I was lucky that I was six when my mum died because I didn't have to lose someone that I'd loved all my life. And when friends lose their mums now and they think I have a clue what they're going through, I'm like, I've got no idea. It sounds so awful. I've got all of that to come. You know, my dad, my auntie who raised me, my sister, or, you know, all this stuff. And I'm like, maybe I got away with that.
But do you not feel now that you have children of your own and you sort of see what you missed out on with your mum?
So much.
That's the pain for you.
Yeah. But it's also mostly Clara, she was 36 when she died. My sadness now is her. It's nothing. My life was fine. Everything, look at me, I'm living a great life. So to think it's part of my story and it's who I am. She was a 36-year-old mother of two young girls, dying, not with her husband, not really knowing what was going to happen. And like, all the sadness is there. But like I said, just to kind of go back onto your point, is that you find yourself going, well, was that better?
Yeah, I know, exactly.
And what a stupid conversation.
It's all shit.
It's all shit.
Yeah,
it's all totally absolutely shit. Horrible.
But how was your grandmother, your mum's mum, alive?
Yes, she was.
So is she still alive?
No, she's not. She was...
How did she deal with losing
her? Oh, terribly. They weren't a hugely emotional couple anyway.
Were they Scottish?
No, they were in my dad's Scottish, mum's side of the family. So we were in Guernsey with her side of the family when she died.
You go and live with your mother's mother?
So when my mum and dad got divorced, I was one in Scotland. My mum left him with my sister and I went down to Guernsey, moved in with her parents. So I lived with my grandparents. And when she died, we carried on living with them for another 3 years. And then when I was 10, moved in with my aunt and uncle.
So you lived with a grieving...
Yes, we lived in a sad house.
Okay.
And after she died, the room that she died in became my bedroom.
Oh my God.
Like it's all, you look back on it and you're like, God. Jesus Christ. It's all so sad.
Okay.
You know, it's like, it's just so sad.
Yeah.
And, but I find myself, like I said, as an adult thinking, well, at least I don't have to deal with losing my mum again. You know,
yes, done it.
And I didn't have to like have a lifetime of having this person. And
until Maud died, my greatest fear, really, well, obviously losing a child, but I didn't think that would happen to me. So that was not even on the agenda, was losing my mother.
Yeah.
It was like, what am I going to do when my mum dies?
Right.
What am I going to do? But now Maud has died, I sort of think, I'm prepared.
Yeah.
Hey!
Yeah, you
every
do.
Cloud!
You definitely
I'm
have
prepared
it.
Prepared now!
It's put something into your soul that prepares you for the worst case scenario.
Yeah.
And what the constant management is, making sure that doesn't bring down the quality of your life and that you can still be a good mum and just happy, basically. And that's the daily challenge,
yes,
isn't it? Knowing that the worst can happen.
Yeah. But also, I mean, I don't know. I feel weirdly, and Jason, I'm not sure he feels the same as me. He thinks I'm a simpleton. I feel really very much more, I don't want to say blessed. I don't really like that word.
I'm going to ask you this question because this is what the podcast is about.
Yeah, yeah.
And it feels like after all of those things that you've just said about yourself. And by the way, just because most people won't know you listening to this, your energy as a person is infectious.
Oh,
when I met you, it was like, I have to have that person in my life. And every time I talk to you, your honesty, your openness. But aside from the things that have happened in your life, your sense of humour and your approach to so many things, I personally fucking adore.
Oh, well, I feel the same, Dawn.
So this seems like a strange question to ask someone who's just, you know, said such tragedy has existed in your life, but would you consider yourself a lucky person?
Yeah.
And how does luck play in your life?
Well, it's funny you should say that because I consider myself a deeply unlucky person and an incredibly lucky person. And I feel I really, really wish that Maud hadn't died.
Mm-hmm.
I really, really wish she hadn't, but she has. And there's nothing I can do about it. So I'm going to take what I can from that. And what she has taught me is that life is really precious. And I know it's really glib and obvious, but I really didn't know it before.
Mm-hmm.
I really, really didn't. Because when Bessie and Maud were young, there was only 16 months between them. And I was really like, oh God, this is so hard. It was so difficult. I was trying to work. I was juggling everything. I was getting really cross with them. I don't want to paint myself as an awful mother because I wasn't.
No, you're just basically describing my life.
Stressful.
Yes.
And I was like, oh God, I needed the childcare to arrive so I could go and make some phone calls and write some emails. And then Maud died. And I was like, what the fuck was that? Why didn't I appreciate every single second that I had her? Why didn't I? And now she's gone. And then I was incredibly lucky, and I really do mean lucky, to be able to have another child, because mm-hmm. I have many friends who've lost older children and they weren't able to have another child. And I think being in a position to have another child after you've lost a child is so healing. It certainly was for me. So I'm very lucky that I had another child, my son Gilbert, and that I just... it's precious. It's so precious. Mm-hmm. And I didn't know it before. And don't get me wrong, I really scream and yell at my children, and they really get on my tits. And I'm not, you know, I'm really cross a lot of the time and angry, especially as now I'm like, you know, perimenopausal. But I have a real newfound sense of, God, it's incredible. This life is incredible. And little moments that would have entirely passed me by before. And I mean little, little moments. Because as you know, those moments, because parenting is so hard and exhausting. And, you know, and so if you do have a moment where you're like, oh, my God, we're all sitting down for dinner and nobody's moaning about the food I've created. Mm-hmm. And we're having a laugh and everyone's being nice to each other. They're magic. Yeah. To me, it's just magic. And they're the moments that I didn't even see them before, but I see them now. So I think I'm incredibly lucky to been able to have another child. And I'm incredibly lucky to have my daughter, Bessie, who is an amazing, amazing child. Mm-hmm. She's nearly 13. She's had to grow up with a very sad, sad mum mm-hmm. and dad at times. And she's had to navigate her way through grief. And she's got a sense of humour. She's funny, which, let's face it, is, I think, the most important thing in life.
Yeah.
You've just got to have a sense of humour about things. And we live a really good life. We're lucky. Jason, my husband's an actor and he works a lot. So we don't have to worry. You know, we're not rich, but we don't have to worry about where the next penny's coming from, which I'm really lucky. That's lucky. It's mm-hmm. brilliant. So I think I'm very lucky and very unlucky mm-hmm. in that the most terrible thing happened to me, but I've tried to make of a really horrendous situation something good.
Yeah.
And that's trying to live a good life, which I hope I'm doing. I'm just really worried that Bessie is going to turn around and, you know, in 10 years and go, you were awful. You were sad all the time. And, you know, I really hope she doesn't do that.
Is it an open conversation in your house?
We talk about Maud a lot, a lot. Bessie, she doesn't want to talk about it so much. She started secondary school. You know, I think she's very much, she does not want to be defined as the kid whose sister died, which I think she might have felt in her primary school because she was.
Yeah.
And I think she's like, you know what? This is, I'm going to take control of this.
Yeah.
So, if she brings it up, we will always talk about it, but I won't bring it up unless she wants to.
I think that's really typical of a teenage. I was the same. When you experience a tragedy young, you bank it and it's you kind of revisit it. Like for me, it was late 20s where you're just like, oh, here it is again. What's happening? Mm. And usually it's, I'd say, it's quite a relief to revisit, but that what she's doing is completely normal, isn't it? She just wants to be a normal teenage girl.
I know. I'm glad you say that, because when she sort of said, I don't want, because she came back from school, she was like, I've got to write a poem for English. And I was like, well, you need to write something you know about. What about writing about, you know, losing your sister, and which is something, you know, is really profound for you? And she was like, no.
Right.
I don't want to do that. And I was like, okay. And I felt sort of hurt, and sort of that Maud was being forgotten. But of course she's not.
No.
It's just Bessie has to find a way, her own way of dealing with it. And I have to find a way of just understanding that that is her way of doing it, because she's finding her way through life now.
And how is it telling, like, Because this is a story you have to tell Gilbert. Like, what what's that been like?
Well, that's been quite interesting because she's very present in our house, Maud. You know, and I think, you know, he will say, in fact, apropos nothing, I don't know where he got this from, he sort of blurted out not very long ago, oh, well, you know, yeah, I mean, I'm the replacement child.
Oh,
I was like,
wow.
What? Well, I am. I mean, I'm the replacement child. He's seven. And I do not know where he got that from because I'm 100% certain we would never have said anything of the sort to him. But I think he's just worked it out.
Right.
I think he's just worked it out. And now, of course, he is the replacement child, but he's so much more than a replacement child because Gilbert, for me, you know, I would never have had three children. Yeah. I was so delighted with my two girls and I was so delighted I didn't have to go through childbirth again and have another pregnancy. I was like, oh my God, I've done it. This is great.
Yeah.
And then as soon as Maud died, I was really a very sort of primal kind of, I've got to have another baby. Mm. This is what I have to do.
Do you mind me asking how old you were?
39.
Okay.
Yeah, 39. So I was... Was I 39? Yeah, I was 39 when Maud died. So also, I didn't sort of, and everyone was like, you need to grieve, you need to. And I was like, fuck off. I haven't got the luxury of grieving here. I've got a body clock.
Yeah.
And I'm deranged and I have to have a baby now. You know, I have to. So there was no time to kind of, I'll take a year or two to grieve and then I'll think about. No, it was like, I need to have a baby now. I need to be pregnant now.
Right.
What was I talking about? I can't remember. It was something to do with Gilbert and being pregnant. And
we lost it. We lost it.
Totally lost it.
Let's see if
totally
it comes back. It. I want to just touch it because we haven't got long left. And you just climbed a mountain.
I did.
Three
mountains. So this was for Child Bereavement UK, another incredible charity that we do quite a lot of work for, Jason and I. They are rather different to Slow. They, Child Bereavement UK, this is your charity, Dawn, because they help children that have lost parents, particularly, and parents who have lost children. In fact, anybody that has been touched by the death of a child.
Right.
They help. Incredible charity. And they asked me to do a three-peat challenge. And I am lazy. So I was like, I don't think I want to do that. And then I heard that it was like five days away in a chalet, in a luxury chalet in Switzerland, France and Germany. And I was like, okay, I'll do that because I get to go away for a few days. And so I went with my friend Susie and a brilliant group of women who I didn't know before, but now we're lifelong friends and just had such a brilliant time.
God, well done.
Proper training. I did proper training. Yeah. Had a really tight ass for about a month. It's all gone to shit now. But I mean, who knew that climbing up hills was the best thing for your body?
I mean, that's why everyone in LA hikes.
I didn't know this.
We've all got amazing buns.
Oh my God, my ass was amazing. It's shit now. It's gone back to
it does,
jelly.
It fades pretty quickly, doesn't it?
Oh God, I need to get one of those Stairmasters in my house because I don't belong to a gym or anything like that. All I do exercise-wise is walk the dog. So I literally am just going up and down Parliament Hill on Hampstead Heath.
Oh, that's good.
That's all I did. That was my training.
Yeah.
Up and down Parliament Hill for about an hour a day. And my arse, oh my God, was amazing.
God,
it was like my 20-year-old self.
I know. It's when you kind of go through one of those stages of doing lots of exercise. You're like, oh, I could look like this all the time.
Are you still doing your bike?
God, I mean,
nightly?
I've got it. It's currently a clothes source, but I will get it back. And what I love about having it is I genuinely will get it back. We had Chris's 40th and just loads, a really indulgent month or two. I had a massive deadline where I was working like 12-hour days. So just kind of, when I get back, I'm looking forward to getting back on it. See, I've got... I'm here on my own, so Chris and the boys are in LA.
Of course.
And I'm getting that kind of, I've got that weird feeling of you thought when you were going to get that trip. I was like, I was really excited. And then as soon as I got here, I'm like, And then I have moments being, this is great because I can have jet lag without worrying about them.
Yeah,
and then
yeah.
And then just kind of, oh God, I'm just so worried about them all the time. There's the LA fires happening and there's the air is full of smoke and it's just like, oh my God, is everything okay? Anyway,
do you wish you were there?
Kind of. And yeah, kind of. I miss them loads. 10 days is a long time for me to be away. But I'm trying also to enjoy it because I don't do this very often. So it's just, you know, it's that weird feeling.
Do you speak to them every day?
The time difference is really hard. And so I'm kind of, you know, on a radio show or something and then they're suddenly at school. So we send lots of videos backwards and forwards. Okay. But I'm missing them like crazy. So, okay, so we're going to wrap it up. I ask everyone, is there anyone's life who you look at and think, God, you're so lucky?
Oh, Christ. Why didn't you pre-warn me?
Options. Well, I personally find it a really odd question, which is why I like asking people. Because I don't know if there's anyone whose life I look at and think, God, am I looking at like Jennifer Aniston and thinking, you'll say, I don't want to be her. So no, it's not someone like that. Am I looking at, I've got some friends back in Guernsey who just have a really nice life with like good jobs and nice house. And they go to the beach everywhere. Maybe that's really lucky. Maybe that's it. I don't know what the answer is. I just think it's like.
Do you know what? I suppose the answer is I really don't think I look at people and feel that
right.
sort of sense of, oh, I really wish I had their life. I mean, I sort of quite like to live in the sun by the sea.
That sounds heaven.
I kind of have like little fantasies about where I would prefer to be sometimes. But I don't.
And point being that no one is really lucky because I've got friends who live that life and half the time they're missing everybody. So it's like.
Exactly. You're not with your kids because you're away. I suppose the thing is, my dream was always to be a really, you know, I wanted to be this sort of, you know, really well-respected actress and, you know, and I do still do a bit of acting and I take it or leave it and I love that I can do that now. So I suppose I would look at actresses that work the whole time. Yeah, this is a good
right.
This is
okay,
a good answer.
Here we go.
We've got there. I would look at actresses and go, what a career.
Yeah.
What an amazing life. You fly around the world. You get to wear incredible clothes and you get loads of free shit.
Free shit's awesome.
Free shit. Nobody sends me free shit. I want free shit. You get free shit and you get the best scripts, the best choice. You work with the best directors, the best writers.
That's pretty sweet.
However, you are not at home with your family.
Well, I live with an actor and it's really hard.
And I live with an actor and he says the same. So he's away filming and I'm just going, you're so lucky because you get to stay in a hotel and you get to sleep and you don't have to wake up at 5:30 with your marauding 7-year-old upstairs. You know, you are so lucky. But of course, he then says, yes, but I miss you all.
Yeah, Chris is like, this isn't good. I'm in a hotel room on my own.
Yes.
But of course,
that's the fantasy for
me. I know.
So you know, this is the thing. Nobody's ever, you know, you always want what the other one's got. But I am a bit of a homebody as well. So actually, the reality of me being a sort of world famous actress and flying around the world, I would hate it.
Yeah, it isn't. It isn't as great as it sounds.
I want to be in my pajamas at 7 o'clock. You know, watching the telly. That's what I really want.
Yeah,
eating nice food.
Yeah. No, I hear you. On word of you being an actress, I wanted to thank you from the bottom of my heart for agreeing to read the part of Ruby on the audiobook.
Pleasure.
So if you have enjoyed the sound of Clara's voice, it's Clara and I on the audiobook of So Lucky. It was when we were trying to cast the part of Ruby, it was who the hell else could I have asked to do
my
it?
Love.
And
I loved it. I loved every second of it.
And you're perfect. So check the audiobook out if you haven't read the book. And thank you, Clara.
My pleasure. What a pleasure.
I'm so grateful to Clara for coming on the podcast and being so unbelievably open about her experience. I loved talking to her and I hope you enjoyed listening to it, despite the fact that it was very sad in places. As this episode drops, Clara is about to star in Leopoldstadt, I think I said that right, a new Tom Stoppard play at the Winmans Theatre in London. Clara is also a designer and her latest collection of dresses called O Pioneers is available online at opioneers.co.uk. I have one, I'm wearing it now and I love it. If you love the sound of Clara's voice, then, as we mentioned in our chat, she is one of the narrators of the audiobook version of my latest book, So Lucky. I'm the other narrator. It's a great audiobook. I think you'll really enjoy it. The book is also out now in print and ebook. Please do make sure that you're subscribed to the podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or on your smart speaker of choice to get each new episode as it drops. If you enjoyed this conversation, I'd so appreciate a review on whatever platform you're listening to this, because it really helps other people find the podcast. Thanks again to Clara, to producer Emma Corsham at Rethink Audio, to Fanula, Liz, Kim, and all the team at HarperCollins, and to you for listening. See you next week.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.